I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of The Bibb Show is brought to you by Bridge Street Capital Partners. Bridge Street is a Sydney-based corporate advisory firm that specializes in equity capital markets transactions for small-cap companies listed on the ASX, primarily in the mining, energy, and tech sectors. If you are a Section 708 sophisticated investor and would like to be on Bridge Street's distribution list for their upcoming capital raisings, send them an email with your details to info@bridgestreetcapital.com.au and mention The Bibb Show in your message. And now, on with the show. Hello, you're listening to The Bibb Show. Bibb is for business, investing, and policy. That's what we're here to talk about. Don't forget to hit subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. A reminder that all the financial information in this podcast is general in nature only. Speak to a professional advisor about your needs. I'm Paul Colgan, director at CT Group, and one of those professional advisors that you might speak to about your needs is James Whelan. How are you, James?
How are you now, Paul?
I'm pretty good. Ken Vexler is off this week with time zones and kids. James, it has been, we're still in lockdown.
Are we still in lockdown?
Yes, we are, mate. And you got to follow the rules. So well, tell me.
Yeah, mate, putting it mildly, it has been a long 2 months. The Goldilocks lockdown of lockdown too soft and now lockdown too hard. People are looking for a glimpse of light at the end of the tunnel, I think you could say. I myself am running on memes at the moment. Who isn't? That's basically been the thing that's been propping us up for the last year and a half. I was reminded of one, anyone who's seen Rogue One, there's a scene where Darth Vader is hidden away and then all of a sudden his lightsaber comes on and you know, sort of leading into what would be the start of New Hope, where he butchers a whole lot of people with his lightsaber. You can't see him. And the caption of the meme says, it says, they tell me that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And then I find out that this is the light. It's just Darth Vader standing there with his lightsaber. Sometimes it does feel a little bit like that. So we're trying to stick to the positive on this one because it could be a bit glum. And so taking a new tack this week, and it's a topic that I don't think a lot of Australians would be too familiar with. He says, tongue firmly in cheek. Our guest this week is Adelaide Timbrell, senior economist at ANZ Research, with a focus on housing, retail trade, and naturally Aussie household wellbeing, which is very important, very important. Now, something that I hope that we dig into later. Thank you for joining us, Adelaide. Welcome to the Bibb Show.
Thank you. Super excited to be chatting to you guys about the economy today.
It's a great day outside. I'm sure I would love to be able to see it, but just as good is sitting here talking about this stuff with you and Paul too. So now straight into it. Big news this week, Adelaide, from you this week. A blindingly bullish call on Australian housing for 2021. Is that written right? 20% growth and change in prices, which is, I'll take a 20. I'll take half that. It's great, which is big in anyone's language, given that we look like we're dangerously close to tipping into another technical recession. Are we allowed to use that word, Paul? Check. What is behind this? Do you want to stretch that out a little bit, Adelaide?
Absolutely. So, yeah, look, 20% housing price growth in a single year sounds really bullish. It sounds really strong. We've got to remember, though, that from the start of the year to the end of July, we've actually already seen 14% house price growth. So, you know, another 6% for the last 4 months, 4 or 5 months of the year. You know, it is a lot, definitely compared to, you know, what you consider a normal year for housing. But considering how we've been going in the first half of this year, it actually, in some ways, the next 12 to 18 months does represent a slowdown. So we're thinking 20% this year and then just 7% next year. The reason for this is comes from a few different places. But basically, there's certain parts of the COVID experience that we've been in the last 18 months that has actually given a group of people a lot more cash and a lot more borrowing capacity to be able to get a nice big home loan. So, you know, when we look back at the last housing boom, it was really all about investors getting into the market and pushing up prices, lots of investors at the auction making things super expensive. But over the course of this year so far, there has been some investor activity, but really the craziness of the housing boom over the last 12 months has more been from upgraders and first home buyers. So people buying a home that they plan to live in rather than, you know, what they plan to use as an income stream. So the people that are upgrading, so second home or, you know, third home or whatever, they are, because of the last housing boom, much more likely to be 35 plus, much more likely to be higher income, much more likely to be in the kind of industry where when a global pandemic hits...
Wait, compared to what?
Compared to the average person in Australia who's living in their own, you know, living outside of their parents' home. So when we look at the people who lost their jobs during COVID, it was young people, it was renters, it was, you know, part-time workers, casual workers, people in hospitality, people with lower incomes. And then on the other side, the people who kept their jobs were more likely to already own a home, more likely to be in a high-income area. And this is something that's particularly given the last 10 years of housing price growth. It's the people that were already locked out of the market that actually then also lost their jobs in COVID. Whereas the people who got in at the, kind of early in the market because they were at the right age or the right income or the right deposit, you know, to buy a home sometime in the last, you know, 8 or 15 or 20 years, these are the people who are more likely to have even more cash than usual. So we were locked at home last year. We couldn't spend any money. If you kept your income, that means you've got more cash. Whereas if you lose your job, obviously that's not the case. And then if you're already a homeowner, you've also saved some dollars on the mortgage because your interest rate has gone down. But if you're a renter, interest rates haven't really had as much of an impact on your life because you don't have 500 grand in mortgage debt. So all of this has come together to mean that people who already owned a home beforehand have put way more money into the housing market. They're also spending a lot more time at home. So suddenly needing an extra bedroom for a home office has become really important. And we are continuing to see this, particularly with really, really low interest rates, meaning you can borrow a lot. And in a weird way, the Sydney lockdown has probably even pushed up housing prices a little bit more because it's delayed the interest rate rise and it's delayed any controls that APRA might put on to make borrowing harder. But if you're not in lockdown city, it has no impact on your own financial situation, but then you don't have to worry about higher interest rates for a longer period.
Everything to this point looks to me like it's fine and there's absolutely no reason to be worried about structural issues. But do you think that the recovery is locked in? Do you think how we think about the recovery, should we be reviewing our views on the snapback? And do you think Delta introduces a new dampening dynamic basically to what we've experienced before?
Look, I think it's pretty fair to say that Delta has really, you know, put a spanner in the works and it has changed everything. At the moment, you know, fiscal support's nice and strong. We know from ANZ spending data that once a city is out of lockdown, not only do they spend as much as they would normally, but they actually go way above the national average for spending to kind of make up for lost time. And that is something that really goes to, you know, stronger consumer confidence than what we saw last year. We've also, you know, the thing about the lockdowns in Delta is that we didn't start in the same position coming into these current lockdowns as we did last year. You know, for example, you know, last year there were all of these businesses and workers who were really relying on international tourism in order to run their business. That's not something that has really been the case this year because we've already gone through that transition. It's the same thing with remote working. You know, there were all these businesses that had to transition to allow, you know, some kind of productivity where no one is in a room together, but you know, a year and a half later, although we've all still had our problems with, you know, Zoom and Microsoft Teams and all of that, we're much further along that path. And that does make the economy a little bit more resilient.
Can I ask you what your view is on this? Like, what in terms of productivity? Because it's a huge question. And frankly, I'm pretty bearish on productivity in terms of, like, when it comes to people working from home. So I'd love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, like, I think there is a real transition period for people who aren't used to remote working to kind of get into it and build up to, you know, having productivity. For some people, it's totally fine. You know, anecdotally, I know there are quite a few introverts around who find that they really get a lot more done at home. But for every one of those... But for any one of those, there's also, you know, people that either go crazy because it's too quiet or they don't have someone to talk to. Certainly a lot of junior employees face, you know, really unique challenges where usually you kind of learn by osmosis in a lot of, you know, professional services and knowledge-based work. You know, you hear how someone handles a problem in the desk next to you, or you ask someone something, and it is a little bit harder to do that if you are working remotely. So there are those challenges there, and I think expecting productivity to be exactly the same, you know, during that transition period is a little unrealistic. On the other hand, you know, you can waste time from anywhere. We can't pretend that people who worked in offices 9 to 5 were working, you know, perfectly 9 to 5. I mean, you know, you only have to walk around any office to see that there's going to be a bit of texting in one corner or Facebook in another corner or some coffee breaks, you know. That's that's all just part of normal life, right? So
I'm the most productive when I'm traveling, when I'm moving. A stagnant water stinks. I get more done from my phone sitting in the Qantas lounge than or just when you're waiting to take off, sitting on the plane. I get more done in that time than I do just sitting at my desk staring at the screen, thinking, oh, well, BHP looks up and down. Funny that you said that, Paul, actually, and well, just give me a sec. But Paul actually mentioned something. I wonder if Adelaide, I'll just bounce this off you. He says that working at home is okay, and it's good, and it's fine, but it's difficult to start new things when we're all in this WFH scenario. What do you, like, off the cuff, what do you think of that with regards to productivity, with regards to innovation, with regards to moving forward as a planet, as a country, not to make it too broad a statement there?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, having new employees is a really perfect example of that.
Yes.
It's really hard to bring someone into a team, you know, as much as... you know, there's so many, you know, different ways that you can break the ice with a team or whatever. I think we all know that going out for a coffee break or going out for, you know, getting on the lines after work, that's the kind of thing that brings teams together. And that really has those productivity improvements over time, having that tight-knit team. So definitely bringing new people into an environment can be difficult. Change management has its own downsides as well. But I think we also, if we take a really long-term view, you know, hot desking and open plan office, this kind of trend, all of the research shows that it's been terrible for productivity. So, you know, if we can, in the longer term, in the future, look at ways to make sure people do have the resources and space they need to work remotely, then we kind of come back to that, you know, personal office space, which really a lot of the research shows is a lot better than open plan, particularly when we look at the way that the structure of knowledge-based work has changed. Office-based work has actually skewed more and more towards quiet individual work rather than collaborative work. So the average person 10 years ago, 20 years ago, was spending more time in meetings doing collaborative work, and the average person now is spending more time alone doing quiet work. And that was, you know, pre-COVID and post-COVID.
Now, Adelaide, I will just throw to you an important point in just 1 second, straight after this. Bridge Street Capital Partners is a Sydney-based corporate advisory firm that specialises in equity capital markets transactions for small-cap companies listed on the ASX, primarily in the mining, energy and tech sectors. Sophisticated investors who want to hear about Bridge Street's upcoming capital raises can send their details to info@bridgestreetcapital.com.au. And that's how you read a bit of copy there, Paul. Now, Adelaide, there was... the note just sort of coming off the back of what Paul said just then, there is a huge, and I saw this too, that people looking at the employment numbers, not necessarily the unemployment numbers, but the employment numbers, as in people who are at home, sitting at home. Now, we can duck and weave this if you want, but the people who are at home who are thinking, I can't go back to work because I've got these kids here and they can't go to school, and that's it. Factoring in the numbers there, how important actually is it to get kids back to school? And I'm sort of giving you the easy question. How important is it to get kids back to school so that we can all get back employed as much and get back to sort of that foolish employment that we should all be striving for?
Yeah, look, I think it's really important to get kids back to school. And this is something that, you know, is important both for parents and children, you know, that socialization and also, you know, the ability to be in a home office where you can focus on work. I think this is something that in particular really a lot of women bear the brunt of productivity impacts and employment availability because of this issue, as much as, you know, it's 2021 and, you know, I tread carefully here because I myself am not a parent, so I can't speak to any specific examples, but I know that it is 2021, but still, you know, there are a lot of, you know, mothers who are either second earners or they are in a situation culturally where they are bearing the brunt of it, or just that sometimes natural inclination of kids to say mum before they say dad. Yeah. And that is something that I think we need to really look into, you know, if Australia does go down that remote working path of making sure that the people who are working remotely have actually the space and the mental capacity to do that productively. There are definitely household wellbeing downsides of remote working, as much as a lot of people do like it. If you're a renter in a big city like Melbourne and Sydney, particularly for people who live in share homes or who live in small apartments, you know, saying, oh, you're working from home for the next 8 months or 12 months, and that's been the situation in Melbourne. If you're, you know, 24 and you've moved to Sydney or Melbourne away from your parents' home and you're renting a $250 room in a house or a $300 room in an apartment, and you've hardly got space for your bed and a desk, that's going to have a real productivity impact compared to someone who's got their own little wing of the house. So there's equality issues around remote working that, you know, we do have to navigate that weren't really there in the office, as much as there was inequality of transport and everything else. You know, if you've got more money, you can live closer to where you work, right? But at least your office was the same size. You know, your desk is kind of the same size, no matter which part of the team you're in or who you are. So yeah, look, there's you know, this having kids in schools is one part of it, but I think there's a broader discussion to be had about, you know, the different role that housing plays in the workforce now that people are more likely to be working from home at least part of the time, and not everyone's home is the same size. Not everyone's home has that space for an office. There are a lot of people working from their bedrooms every single day, and I think certainly, you know, one of the really big impacts that we've seen over the last 18 months, this is quite different to what we've seen in previous recessions and previous economic downturns, is it's, you know, people who have a lower income are more likely to have lost far more money than people who have a higher income. So whether you've worked in, you know, hospitality or the retail sector or any tourism-related or arts and recreation-related industry, not only are you already more likely to be a renter, you're already more likely to be living in a smaller dwelling, you're also more likely to have lost work, and not having work to do during lockdown creates those mental health effects as well. I mean, you know, I remember even just being on annual leave, you know, during lockdown. It's really tough compared to having something to distract you for 8 hours a day. So that is something that I think is going to have really far-reaching effects. But even within, you know, knowledge-based workers who do have a good income, there's within those industries, there are people who are expected to work from home full-time who, even if their income is okay or they're starting out in an industry where their income will eventually be good, that doesn't mean that they can afford a home office space now. I mean, an extra bedroom has never been more expensive in Australia. So particularly in places like Melbourne and Sydney where the lockdowns have been happening
most. Let me stop you on that. Why is an extra bedroom so expensive?
Because so as housing prices rise, you know, the money that you have to pay in order to rent a three-bedroom house compared to a two-bedroom house in terms of dollars, even if it's the same percentage difference, is going to be higher over time. So, you know, if a three-bedroom house back in the day was $100,000 more than a two-bedroom house and now it's $300,000 more, then that means that extra bedroom essentially is a $300,000, you know, extra bedroom in some areas of the city. So, you know, when you look at the way that our budgets as households have changed over time, we've had to put more of our money into the housing market, into buying ourselves space. And so every square meter of that in a city becomes a more expensive square meter to buy. And particularly as rates go down, it's not necessarily, once you've got the mortgage, it's not as bad, but getting to that point is harder and harder and harder. And then suddenly there's all these people that, you know, want to have a comfortable home, and they go, if I'm working from home and my partner is working from home and we want to have a kid, suddenly they need a four-bedroom house or a five-bedroom house, and, you know, that's $3 million. So it's really hard to see how these things are going to come together. You know, housing used to just be for your, you know, leisure time, for when you sleep and then you go to work, and so you don't have to house your work. But now, if remote working becomes expected, or if it becomes a really big part of that, you know, post-COVID normal, then the role of your home expands, but your wage doesn't expand. The support you have in order to fund that extra role in your home doesn't expand. And that's something that's okay if you've got a lot of spare money rolling around, but if you don't, it's really going to be difficult.
No, it's not. I think that a lot of the sign-on for, and I'm just about to change gears on this, but I think that a lot of the sign-on and a lot of the job shifting and a lot of the deals that are done to bring on new employees does and will include, you know, get the right chair, make sure you've got two monitors, make sure your internet is set. That's now part of the package. Now, I know that's only a relatively small handful of people that's there, but it's sort of now becoming the norm. I think it's becoming the norm globally. But Adelaide, now it's time to shift. Now, you mentioned rates, you mentioned mortgages, you mentioned all the nonsense that comes with it. Let's stick to GDP growth outlook. So let's look at the big picture. What's your GDP outlook for the next year? And with regards to monetary policy view, how, I have asked this question numerous times, what does normalisation of rates look like? If you could get to that question at any time, that'd be fantastic. But let's just start with your growth outlook and your GDP outlook and the big picture for the Oz.
Sure. So here's where my real expertise comes in.
Ooh, here we go. Stand back.
Yeah. Yep. Housing and GDP is a little bit easier to talk about than all of those tricky social inequality issues that we will see over time.
Yeah.
So, look, it's not often that I would ever say a 3.3% fall in a single quarter of GDP is not so bad, but after last year when we did have that 7% fall in GDP in the June quarter, 3.3% feels a little bit more manageable. So we're thinking 3.3 for the current quarter. That's really based on Delta. It's based on the fact that over half of Australia is in lockdown right now. Our ANZ spending data shows that when you're in lockdown, the city that's in lockdown spends 30% less, coming from, you know, credit card, debit card and merchant data. So that's a really big deal. And then so from there, you know, you've also got all of the business disruptions and things that come with that. So 3.3 down. But, you know, depending on how lockdowns go next quarter, we could see a 2.4% increase from there, and the actual overall GDP change for the year would then be positive 1.4. So we're not at the moment expecting a recession to happen where GDP is going down twice in a row.
Yep.
But we are really feeling, we know that the impact of Delta is really huge. When it comes to unemployment, though, we think it'll be an average of 5.1% over the December quarter. So, and then go down from there. We're actually still thinking that 2023 will be an average of 4% unemployment, which is way lower than we've seen in ages. And so even though we're seeing this temporary lift in unemployment, it's nowhere near as bad as last year. It got to 7.5 last year. And if we included all the people that weren't looking for jobs because, you know, there weren't any.
What's the point?
You can think of the effective unemployment rate as more like 13%.
Yeah.
Whereas these days, there's heaps of job ads out there. There's heaps of job vacancies out there. Employers are going to be a lot more scared to lay someone off because the cost and the risk of getting someone back when they want to expand or when they want to bring back workers is going to be a lot harder now than it has been. We don't have, you know, any immigration coming in, and every worker across most industries really have more options than they did, not just last year, but more options than they did back in 2019. We think of 2019 in some ways as like the golden age where we could like go to cafes and everyone was, you know, doing whatever they wanted all the time. But from an economic perspective, the momentum of 2019 was slow. We were already expecting to see unemployment go up. Everything was slowing down. 2021, yes, we've got challenges, you know, in terms of, you know, your household well-being, your freedom of movement, all of those things. It's definitely, you know, in a lot of cases worse. But the economic momentum that's underlying everything's actually going, you know, at a quicker pace. We're seeing more people wanting more workers. And because a lot of businesses now have adapted to the idea that the government is going to keep splashing cash as these lockdowns continue, they're less likely to let go of people. They're more likely to take financial risks. We can see that households are taking financial risks, not just in the housing market, but if you've tried to buy a car anytime recently, it's been really, you know, that's really difficult. Buying a caravan, buying a puppy, you know, people are spending money wherever they can to make their lives feel a little bit better.
Adelaide, spin the wheel, transitory or not transitory?
So, look, I mean, oh, I hate to be a stereotypical economist, but, you know, I'd love to say a bit from column A, a little bit from column B. I think structurally over time, inflation has been getting lower and lower and lower. And so for me, when I see pockets of inflation or I see increases in inflation that are really strong and really fast, I would say transitory for that. Doesn't mean that I think that inflation is going to be at, you know, 1.5 forever, but, you know, there is some market expectation now that we won't see, you know, interest rates above that kind of 2% mark in the very long term. And I really, you know, if I had to put my money on it, I would be saying, you know, 2% or less rather than 2% or more in that kind of 5 to 10 year period. And that's because inflation, there's a lot more globally, there's a lot more stuff that pushes it down than that brings it up. I mean, oil is cheap. Digitization makes it super cheap to compete between other countries for anything from, you know, professional work to physical goods. The fact that we're buying more physical goods than services at the moment, and that's something that we're seeing all over the world, even in higher vaccinated countries, we're spending more time at home, we're buying more stuff. It's you know, risky to plan a trip, but it ain't risky to buy a couch. So that pushes inflation down too, right? Because the average basket of stuff that you buy is more likely to be stuff that falls in price over time rather than stuff that rises in price over time. So when it comes to looking at what might move the needle on inflation, I think it's really kind of if it's something where it can lead to wages going higher. So things that aren't tradable, you know, if you're, you know, you can buy coffee beans from anywhere in the world, and so that kind of commodifies the price a little bit, but you can't buy a barista coffee anywhere in the world because you have to be where the barista coffee is in order to enjoy it. And so, you know, if we get that nice relationship between wages and all the stuff that you can't really move around, then we do have more of a chance of getting inflation to where it needs to be. But that slice of goods and services gets smaller and smaller and smaller as technology becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger part of our lives. So whether it's a good or a service, like, you know, services like internet, I mean, you don't have to be down the road from a person selling you a modem in order to get internet from a particular provider, even though it is the service. So I think, you know, I think that's something that really structurally keeps inflation down. And I also think that central banks, you know, there's a lot of pressure on central banks to help the economy and help inflation, but They've only got a really blunt tool, and I think that tool was kind of really useful when inflation was high and we wanted to make it lower, but it doesn't seem to be quite as useful when inflation is low and we want to make it higher. So, you know, our forecasts say that by the time it hits the middle of 2023, we will have 2% inflation, and then we will see rates go up, but they're going to go up really slow, really, really slowly over a really long period of time, and they won't get very high. And that's because of all of this stuff that's making it really hard to get a captive audience, which is what you need to put prices up. Like, you know, I'm a captive audience to the coffee that I buy down the road because I'm not going to spend 20 minutes driving to, say, 50 cents on the coffee. But I'm not a captive audience for most goods and services because I have a computer, I have a phone, and so I can kind of, and that's really the challenge.
Thank you, Adelaide. Bridge Street Capital Partners, as mentioned before, Sydney-based corporate advisory firm, proud sponsors of the BIP Show. Thank you very much for your support, putting together capital market transactions and small cap companies on the ASX. Mining, energy, tech sectors, sophisticated investors, get in touch with us or get in touch with Bridge Street's email address that's here, info@bridgestreetcapital.com.au, and they'll be able to help you out. Now, don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate us, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on iTunes at The BIP Show, obviously, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Twitter for some reason. It's at @the_BIP_show, and we're on Facebook too, again, for some reason. Just search The BIP Show. I have a website, again, for some reason, which is now hosting all the little extras and bits and pieces. Adelaide, send me any extra documents that you want to have on there, any views that you've got, and I'll put them on the website. We've got things that are on there. I do a little bits and pieces, and we also got links to the show too. Google Whelan Capital, which is what I named it because it was late and that's what I decided, and follow the links to the BIP Show individually at Colgo, at James Whelan 42, and at Ken Vexler. Sorry, you couldn't be here, Ken. Adelaide, I'm not sure if you're on Twitter.
I try to make it fun, but, you know, there's only so many ways you can make a chart, right?
Somehow I've managed to get through my life without seeing you on Twitter, but I'm going to absolutely amend that, and I do apologise. I look forward to having you back on the show, Adelaide. I think that there's some unfinished business that's here, and you've got a lot more to say, which is fascinating. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Adelaide. This show is produced by Rick Salter. G'day, Rick, and we'll catch you next time. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. You've got to give us those 5-star ratings. They are very helpful. It's really easy to do. But thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.